And I would give you also copies of all of the documents that, briefs and so on, that were on file in that case.
Thank you very much. Oh, yes, sir.
I think Fred Paul testified before you in Anchorage.
Yes, he did. He did. He did. Well, thank you very much. Well, I'm very glad you came down, Mr. Jackson, and it's certainly been helpful, and I'm afraid I've run out of questions.
If anybody else has questions, I'd be pleased to try to answer them.
Mr. Berry, going back to the village of Goodtown.
Could you give us our your name, ma'am?
Lillian Preston. I'm originally from Maine. You mentioned the IRA are taking the land there. And isn't Venati and Arctic Village are they on a reservation?
No.
Is there a difference between that and the other villages?
Right. Let me explain that. Under the Act, one of the ideas that I had was that a reservation ought to be able to keep its lands, and that we wouldn't count the land that they received against the 40 million acres. Under that provision, Venetai and Arctic Village elected to receive the land. They only received $100,000 in cash, but they got a very large area, 1.5 million acres. Then those village corporations, business corporations, would have been an ordinary village business corporation, except they would have been land poor, lots of land but very little money. But then Don Wright, who was an advisor to the villages, discussed with them the possibility of putting the land, the remaining assets of the business corporations, into the IRA corporation, which already existed. So the reservation lands, with the reservation terminated, but all the land that had been in the reservation was turned over to that IRA corporation. Now, that IRA corporation believes that they have an arguable, at least, right to additional land, but up until now they've been unable to find an attorney who will take their case. They want additional land.
Did anyone else have a question for Mr. Jackson? Yes, sir.
What about a model like the Navajo Reservation in the Southwest? That's a pretty large scale.
Could you give us your name, sir, just for the record?
Brian Mitchner.
I had been on the Navajo Reservation when I was about 16, 17 years old, and I was somewhat familiar with their system. The problem that I found, it appeared to me, they are a strong tribe, and I think they're doing pretty well. But the problem that I saw from the standpoint of the Alaska Native was that the Alaska Natives generally had not had reservations and moved freely between the villages and the towns. And at least at that time, if you were Navajo, you could not get the benefits of tribal membership, or being a member of the Navajo Nation, unless you lived on the reservation or very close to it. So if you wanted to move to Los Angeles, you were just an Indian in the city then.
I think it depends on the benefits. Many of them, in fact, maintain their ties on the reservation.
I think that's correct.
Go, it's not a clear cut.
Right.
Cutting traces.
Yeah. The other problem that I had with that approach was that in nearly every village in Alaska, there is a small group of non-natives. And it seemed to me that there would be a lot of objection to establishing each village as, in effect, a mini reservation.
One other matter that arises out of the answer you just gave to Mr. Michener, the Act provides that something like 1,200 acres is to be conveyed by each village corporation to the municipality to be chartered by the state, or if one exists to the municipality itself.
Right.
Was that intended to ensure that there wouldn't be reservations on each village site?
That was, I think, one of the purposes, was to make sure that there would be some land in the area that was not controlled by the Village Business Corporation, to make sure that there was some land available to the municipality for municipal functions, to make sure that there was some land available to the municipality that it might sell for, how should I say, development of the community, not just for cash proceeds, but to facilitate development. If somebody wants to put in a freezer plant, where are they going to get it from? If you can only get it from the Village Business Corporation, it might not be a socially wise situation.
Yes, sir. Could you give us your name?
Yes, sir. Walter Powers, and you had mentioned earlier the benefits of merging village corporations, and you had also mentioned that it was your original intent to have one regional corporation for Alaska.
No, both 12 regional corporations plus a statewide business corporation.
And what purpose does it serve over the 12?
The statewide business corporation, well, you'd end up with stock in a village corporation, you'd end up with stock in a regional corporation, and you'd end up with stock in a statewide. One of the reasons for that? One of the reasons was that if any one corporation went under, you still had stock in two other corporations. Another concept was that the statewide business corporation could act as a political force for the business interests of Alaska Natives. In fact, that rule has been largely carried out by the Alaska Federation of Natives because we didn't set up a statewide corporation. Congress objected to this concept of the statewide Native corporation, and specifically Ted Stevens, I believe. Now, he never told me this directly, so it's hearsay, okay? But he felt that as a Republican, he had a chance of talking to individual regions and getting their support. But with the Alaska Natives leadership overwhelmingly Democrat, he would never have a chance of getting the endorsement of the statewide business corporation. And I think that's a legitimate concern. Incidentally, the regional concept was also intended to provide for competition and the benefits of competition, and to lessen the fear of non-native Alaskans that the natives of Alaska were going to take over the state.
Possibility that the regionals might decide it would be to their benefit to merge, maybe not as a whole unit.
Not
one or two.
I think a merger of all 12 would be very unwise. However, Atna is a very small corporation that is Athabascan, with a lot of links to Doyon, and I could see a Doyon Athabascan merger. Except my own, it's none of my businesses give my opinion on this. I think Otten is better run, and they might not want to merge with Doyon. They might feel they're better off, even though they're small, staying on their own.
Well, any other questions for Mr. Jackson? Well, any other comments you wish to make, sir?
I still feel the same way as I did in 1971. It's a tremendous opportunity. If you've got a tremendous opportunity, you've also got a tremendous possibility of really messing things up. But I think Alaska's Native leadership collectively is the strongest group of leaders among Aboriginal peoples, in at least in the Western Hemisphere. And I think they've got the capability of pulling it out. I think they're learning. I think the learning curve is taking longer than we anticipated. But we're getting there. I think they're getting there. And I anticipate that before much longer, six of the regional corporations will be on Fortune's 500 list.
One of them is there now.
Mm-hmm.
Would it... Can you tell me the names of the other five? I'm
well, it's Prime candidates would be Doyon, Cook Inlet, and Arctic Slope.
I see. Well, on that optimistic note, let me thank you, Mr. Jackson, for coming down and for answering my questions and those of everyone else here.
Thank you very much, sir.
Well, does anyone else wish to make a presentation this morning? I don't suppose everyone has Mr. Jackson's knowledge of the act, but... All right.
My name is Judy Bauman. I'm in Doyon. At the Republican convention, something came up, a resolution that was proposed and passed that was very upsetting to me. And right now, this time, since I don't understand like the Constitution of the State of Alaska and what it has set out as far as recognizing sovereignty and for the natives and them being able to live off their land, I don't understand yet, you know, what that all involves, but this resolution that they proposed doesn't sound good to me, and I want to share what they've come up with. At the Republican convention in District 19 where I was the only Native at that convention, and what it had appeared to me is that a few years ago when they had their last Republican convention in Fairbanks, it was one big convention. They had the whole area. And this time they broke it up. They had three or four different districts within the Fairbanks area. And it appeared to me that a bunch of Republicans that had been Republicans for many, many years got together and decided on certain resolutions that they would propose at the convention. And each district convention proposed and passed the same resolution. So when they go to the state, it's going to be coming up again. They titled it Sovereignty and Private Lands. Whereas various private entities in Alaska are advocating self-governance, control and management of all resources, including fish and wildlife on their lands, under provisions of the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934 as amended, and whereas such fragmentation of authorities is in direct conflict with the Alaska State Constitution, and whereas it is not in the general public interest to permit the development of sovereignty status for any private lands in Alaska, and whereas the state constitution can only be amended by the voters, and whereas there are numerous legal questions associated with the sovereignty issue, now therefore be it resolved that any attempts by any individuals or organizations to attain sovereignty over lands in Alaska must be recognized and proclaimed as a threat to the people and the state of Alaska. And be it further resolved that all public officials have responsibility to Alaska's people and resources to resist strongly all moves for sovereignty. And be it further resolved that the state of Alaska take the action necessary to preclude any formal or informal recognition of organizations attempting to attain self-governing powers contrary to the Alaska Constitution, and be it further resolved that the state of Alaska take the action necessary to acquire a formal U.S. Supreme Court declaratory judgment of some type on the legal status of sovereignty declarations under the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934. And I don't understand how they can even say this. And I didn't know when they read this resolution how to even respond to it.
Well, of course, it's a free country, and they can pass any resolution they want. You might go back to the convention and tell them that President Reagan, in an official policy statement that he issued last year from the White House, affirmed the principle of sovereignty for Native American tribal institutions. But it's something for them to decide, and for you to decide, and for people here to decide for themselves. But it might interest them to know that the president has taken a stand on the matter that seems to be a lot closer to sovereignty than the local group in District 19 is. But those are political questions, and no doubt they'll all be ironed out in some way.
Thank
That's
you.
The best I can do.
Thank you.
What's the resolution number on that?
Well, this was out of District 19, resolution number 5.
Number 5, okay.
They're going to have...
That's the Fairbanks area, isn't it?
Right, and they're going to have the state... the state convention here in Fairbanks, the first part of May. And anyone can go to the convention, whether they are delegates or not, they just won't have a voice. So you can go and listen to what's going on. You just won't have a vote.
We can still write to our congressmen.
Right.
Our legislators.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Paul.
My name is Philip Penatak. I live here in Fairbanks, and I'm a full-blooded Nupiaq. I'd just like to make an additional comment as to the resolution that was read by this lady here. I haven't heard her read all the resolution, but I understand what it is, and I'd like to connect what that resolution means to what I said yesterday, because I spoke here before and I stated that colonialism is in existence and that we Native people, the indigenous people, are victims of colonialism and are the colonized, and that the colonizers are those that put us through all these hardships we go through in trying to struggle to survive. And I stated that yesterday, for the colonizers, the unjustifies to me. The end is profit. They do anything for profit. And among the colonizers are those that are within the state of Alaska and the United States federal government. And most notable among these are transnational corporations. The end justifies the means for the colonizers. Any threat to their ends, they'll try to do away with. And one of the ways they're doing it is through resolutions passed by the Fairbanks delegations to the state of Alaska, of the state government. It's the only addition I'd like to make, and additional comments. Thank you.
Yes, where are you from originally?
Well, I was born in Nome, Alaska, and our people are from King Island.
Oh, I see.
And we are King Islanders, and I was born in Nome. I live here in Tauno.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Benedict. Well, as I said earlier, we've had approximately 70 people make presentations at the university and downtown since we've been in Fairbanks, and this time for a few more, if anyone else would like to speak this morning.
Are you going to break for lunch and then come back this afternoon?
No, we were thinking of just carrying on for as much longer as was necessary to accommodate those who wish to speak.
My name is Pat Isaacson. I'm on the board of directors for Bean Ridge Corporation, which would be Manly Hot Springs. I'd like to say something about the corporation itself. Being result-oriented, the only thing we can look at is what is going to be the end result of the corporate activity. And I feel like Doyon and maybe even Tanana Chiefs have not really monitored the situation. They haven't said, well, you're spending too much. You're not making enough profits. They haven't really been looking over their shoulder, so to speak. Neither has the federal government. And
you
there's
mean
no
haven't been looking over the shoulders of the village corporations.
Right, correct. When I was president of the corporation back in 1974 through 76, Doyon came to us and they said, this is your spending limit, and we don't want you to exceed that. And what it was a simple formula for don't spend more than you make. Now, this is what I learned when I was selling newspapers on the streets of Fairbanks. And it's very simple. You know, if you don't have a business, a viable business going on, you don't put out money for things like wages and expensive offices and office equipment that you're not going to need until you actually start getting into business and making the proper investments and getting money back to replace the money you've spent. And I just don't feel like there's been any monitoring or control. And the result is, we see in the village a diminishing of actual funds, seed money. I think it was Goethe that said seed corn should not be ground. But I'm in a position right now where we have 4,200 shares. My family owns 1,000 shares. That's 23%. We started out with initial capitalization of $253,000. I think right now we have about $113,000 in the bank, and there's a few more dollars spread around here and there. But what I'm trying to say is nobody's really, really been watching, you know, and monitoring. And we have a real lack of talent in the villages. And strange to say this, but my village is one of the ones that is better off. There are other villages that are far below our standard, our level, as far as profitability and amount of retained capital, you know, from the principal they started with. And it's getting to be a matter of concern because we have 7 years left. And we don't have any land that we can live on. The corporation is very arbitrary in their, or can be very arbitrary in who gets land and who does not. And if you don't have any native allotment, how are you going to live in the village? The corporate system, I've always considered the corporate system to be an alien system created by the nobility of Europe, the great, Hudson's Bay Company, East India Company, West India Company. The great nobilities of Europe have created this system for us. And I would have preferred a system we had developed along our own lines, our own cultural lines, something that would have, we could understand better. This is the great complaint that I see today is a lot of Native people say, well, I can't understand this corporate system, or it's too complicated. It's totally alien to their lifestyle. And as I look down the road, I see we have 7 years left. And within those 7 years, I can't tell my brothers and sisters, hey, don't sell that stock if they don't, number one, have a place to live. Number two, it's not making them any money. You know? Number three, they don't live in the village. So what good is it? What practical use is there? It would be better to, well, we have four options. Number one, either they become profitable. Number two, we divide the land in subsidiary units, the money and the land. Or number three, we sell our stock. Number four, we buy stock. You know, those are the only four options available to us as I see it today. And of course, I don't want to be the one to say that I'm for selling stock. But if management doesn't turn the corporation around, what are we left with?
What did you mean, one of the options is to buy stock?
Well, we own 23% by a controlling interest.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. You're speaking of your family.
That's if they don't change the rules of the game.
Yeah. Well, how do you feel about changing the rules of the game? You're opposed to changing the rules of the game.
Well, there are two sides to that, obviously. If you change the rules to the game and say only certain people can buy stock, well, then you limit what you're going to get for that stock, obviously, I think. You know, you're not going to get your fair market value out of it.
If you do what Mr. Jackson urged earlier, that is, you can sell in 1991, but only to Native people.
Yes. So it puts the seller at a disadvantage. But on the other hand, if you allow this stock to be alienated into the non-Native community, there's always the chance that you're going to lose your land and your corporation. So we have here a paradox, and a person really doesn't know which side to be on, depending whether he's a buyer or a seller.
Well, let me ask you one question. Is it your view of 1991 that if the stock is worthless, the corporation is not profitable, people will sell their stock, but that if the corporation is making money, people won't sell their stock? Is that what you're saying? Because I would have thought it would be the other way around.
That's a good question. I don't think the majority of Native people are going to be wanting to get rid of their stock. But on the other hand, there's a lot of people that, if this thing doesn't have any results, they have needs. They have needs that have to be taken care of, and they're not going to be able to wait any longer.
Right. If you've got a corporation that is making money and distributing dividends, then the shareholders are getting something.
Correct.
And they may hold on to their shares.
I think they'd be more apt to hold on to shares that are making money and creating dividends. And even perhaps a small land disposal in exchange for stock. A small, you know, say if a person has 100 shares, trade 10 for some land. They can actually call their own.
And trade 10 to the corporation for some land.
This is an idea that's I've not heard anybody bring up before, but it's always been in the back of my mind, and I see no reason why it can't be accomplished. I mean, we have fair exchange of stock for land. Of course, you'll never get what that stock is actually worth, you know, in terms of land. If you did, you'd be very well off. But as far as profitability of the corporation, we have a real lack of talent. The federal government just hands out this money and there's no training. There's no effective monitoring system. Nobody's looking at the results. And the corporation can be as arbitrary as they want to be without anybody saying, hey, this isn't being done right, or why are you losing all this money? As intervention, if the federal government had done it.
Yeah.
So what we're facing is a real, real crisis, a very real crisis. I've been working on this thing since 1972, and I'm beginning to feel the panic. And pretty soon we're going to have a search for the guilty, I guess, like that little thing said you had over there on the table. Then we'll punish the innocent. Okay.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
My name is Maria Hajdukovic-Hollander, and that's H-A-J-D-U-K-O-V-I-C-H. And I'm sorry I didn't get here the other day. I wonder if there was anyone from Anaktuvik Pass here. Yeah, very good. I was very fortunate. I was born and raised in Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm a 40-year resident and have never, until Monday this last week, been into a village. And I flew in with Frontier Flying. My brother owns Frontier Flying Service. And I flew in on business. And Mr. Isaacson was just talking about talent. And as he was talking about it, I had no intention to speak today. But I was very impressed, as a professional businesswoman here in Fairbanks, with that village corporation. I have it written down. I know it starts with an N. And Roosevelt Paniak, of course, is the president of the corporation, and Steve Wells is the business manager there. And I just wanted the whole world to know how impressed I was as a pioneer Alaskan, a native of Alaska. I think, do you call it native of Alaska? Or pioneer Alaskan. My parents came here in the late 1800s. And my uncle, John Hajdukovic, of course, is well known down in Big Delta, et cetera. But I believe with a tremendous teamwork between professional people like myself and like my brother in management and working together with, you know, the Eskimos and the Indians of Alaska, I think we can really move ahead. I was impressed, and I wanted on record that Anaktuvik Pass is a very impressive, beautiful place. Thank you for letting me talk.
Thank you, Ms. Hollander. Philip, those papers you gave me, could I take them with me and photostat them and mail them back to you?
Sure.
Could you give me your address here in town? Just write it out for me. Do you have it?
I have it.
Oh, fine. Okay. Well, the meetings have gone very well in that we've had discussions of broad questions of principle, and then this morning we had Mr. Jackson and Mr. Isaacson getting down to some of the very practical questions that will arise in 1991, and very helpful, and Ms. Ballman kept us advised of what's happening in the Republican Party, and that it's bound to be useful to us to know.
Well, last person that sat here on this seat was, I could identify as a colonizer. And colonialism works in subtle ways. I know there's some people that laughing at me right now or doubt me. I say these things right now out of impulse and out of thought. I just want to state that colonialism is manifested in many forms, and colonialism in action was witnessed with the lady before me that sat here. And another thing, I stated that we are the colonized and victims of colonialism, but I haven't made any recommendations as to how to struggle against colonialism. What we do need is help from international bodies to have the real tradition of people to study international laws that will benefit them and lead them towards to decolonization. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, maybe I could just say if you decide you want to send anything to us in writing to our office in Anchorage, please feel free to do so, and we'll treat that written presentation as part of the permanent record. Our office is 429 D Street in Anchorage, and Mary Kenswick, who lives here in town, is working with us, and you can get in touch with her if you wish. We are going to have a meeting in Nenana at 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, and then we are having a meeting in Tanacross at 1 o'clock on Monday afternoon. and then we are taking a break, and then we are holding meetings in May in Southeast Alaska for 2 weeks at Juneau, Ketchikan, Sitka, Angoon, and Klawak. And we don't expect that we will see any of you at those meetings, but we thought you might like to know about them.
I'm Georgiana Lincoln, and I'm testifying just on my own individual basis and not in affiliation with either my village or regional corporation. Before I start my testimony, I'd like to prefix that by my reluctance to come up and to testify. I've been listening to different people throughout this hearing and following in the papers some of the hearings that have been going on throughout the state. And I say that I am very reluctant to come up and testify because we have had so many studies done by various governmental, private organizations and private individuals that say they're going to do this and that with the studies, and that it's going to be helpful to us as Native people. In reading what the Alaska Native Review Commission's function is, I really can't read in there how it's going to benefit me, the shareholder of the village or regional corporation. And the only thing I think that I did read in there, that it might be beneficial to others who are going through a land claims settlement. And there certainly is much to learn from our mistakes and the positive aspects of it. But I am not sure that I endorse the Alaska Native Review Commission because I don't know enough about it. However, any time a hearing is held, I think we as Native people have a tendency to feel that we should testify in case something is going to change for us, either for the better or the worse, that we want the individuals that are responsible for the hearings to know what we as individuals personally feel. And so there's always that coming forth, not necessarily that we believe in the hearings, but that we're afraid that if we don't speak up, that something worse might happen. And I did want that to be stated, you know, on the record. I think from the very beginning on ANSCA, and I don't believe that it has changed any more today than it was in 1971 or before 1971, that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, that we're supposed to understand. Now, I'm supposed to be very knowledgeable about the act, and I can tell you with all honesty that I don't understand every single thing in that act. It is an attorney's paradise and our nightmare.
You said you're on the board of DOYON, I believe.
I did not.
Oh, well, are you?
Yes, I am. I'm also on a village corporation board, Rampart Village Corporation Board. But I, as I said, I'm making a statement as an individual and not on behalf of either.
I understand.
I lost my train of thought.
Sorry, you said an attorney's...
Oh, that...
Dream and...
It is an attorney's dream and the shareholder's nightmare. I am sorry I missed Barry's presentation here because he was involved in the very beginning of it, and I don't think that he fully understands what is going on with the act itself. It's a very short time for us as Native people to even come before you or whoever to say that this is what we feel, that if we revise that act, this is how it should be written, and then all of our problems would be gone. I don't think that even if we sat down today and wrote that act over again, that we would have a perfect document that we are all satisfied with. I believe that even today, in looking at that and reading it, there are words that even the lawyers disagree over what the meaning is of that English term. And I'm sure you've already had testimony, especially from the elders, that when they spoke, the word was good, that it was in honesty that it was said, and that I don't even think they had to have a handshake, that it was so. And now, as board members or shareholders, we have to be very responsible, or know that term, fiduciary responsibilities. That we are responsible not for one shareholder or those that reside in the village, but we have to be responsible for all of our shareholders. That's very difficult to understand. That it goes far beyond. We go into other countries, that we have to respond the same way to people who live in foreign countries as we do to those who live in the United States, to those who live in an urban in Alaska, to those that live in the village. And whether it is negative or not, I certainly feel that ANSCA has divided our people terribly. We've divided ourselves in rural. I never heard when I was growing up, you're an urban Indian. And now I almost feel like when I'm called an urban Indian, I'm being called a dirty name. Because we have rural, urban, we have shareholders in Alaska, we have those outside of Alaska, that we divide ourselves there. We divide ourselves at shareholders in the lower 48 versus shareholders in another country. We divide ourselves in that we have village councils, city councils, village corporations, regional corporations, IRAs, state, federal, and private. And I don't think that there's any other people in this world except for Native peoples who have to deal with all of those types of governments. You yourself, you either deal with your state government, your private, or your federal. And we've got all of these layers and layers and layers of different types of governments that have, I think, divided us more so. I'm not saying that anyone is right or wrong, but that it's very confusing to people. I heard testimony yesterday about the allotments, and speaking with some of those after their testimony to give them direction as to where they could go for further answers for their native allotments. But it's very confusing as to whether it's for our area here, whether it's a Doyon responsibility or a Tan the Chief's responsibility, or whether it's a village council responsibility, or whether it's the city of Fairbanks, or even the borough of Fairbanks that's responsible for that particular action. In speaking about lawyers, I think I also want to add in my testimony that we have certainly trained many, many lawyers to be experts now in ANSCA. We have set up many, many lawyers in businesses to then turn around and to give us advice on what we trained them to do. And very costly. I think ANSCA is a very costly act to, especially our village corporations, where a requirement to have a audit done yearly. That's a very costly thing if you are a very small village corporation. I think for us to be experts in not only the governmental structure, but to also, excuse me, sit there and to be experts on whether to invest in a shoe business, whether to invest in oil and gas leasing, whether to lease our land to a large mineral company, whether to go into movies, whether to go into grocery business, whether to go into real estate. I mean, it's a very complex businesses that we were almost forced into versus any other corporation in this world, that when they form a company, they form a company for a specific task. Either they're going to be making cars, or they're going to be real estate, or they're going to be a movie company, or something. But they go into it already knowing what they're setting up their company to do. That's unlike us, who inherited corporations that were told to now go out and invest. And invest wisely, because you only have till 1991, whatever that magic is supposed to be about 1991. And many villages and many corporations did do just that. And I, in the beginning, was involved in that, where we had people coming out of the woodwork who were experts, who just knew how we should invest our money, because it was going to make us millions of dollars in return. It was very difficult to analyze those things and to get the expertise to give us that advice. And I think it still is. Except now we're talking about more and more money. I think that we started with a very small, looking at proposals that were very small, and right or wrong, grew to looking at proposals that were very large. And I think that this comes from the village and regional corporations. We analyze different than we even do now. Previous speakers addressed the fact that the 1991 issue in selling stock and whether it would be sold. I believe that, without a question in my mind, that it's not so much as how much money has the corporation given us in dividends as what has the corporation done for us. Has the corporation given us, say, scholarships? Has the corporation provided us employment? Has the corporation protected our lands? What other benefits can we derive out of our corporation? And without a question, if those things cannot be answered positively, I certainly feel that the shareholders are going to look elsewhere for those answers. Now, whether that's trading or selling their stock or whatever, but we must be realistic about it. I think that if you look back in the corporations, whether they're village or regional corporations, you'll see where we can't sell our stock yet, but we can give our stock away. And I don't think that people have thought very hard about the number of people that will be giving their stock away, not selling, but giving it. And we have seen a number of our stock, and I won't give percentages, but throughout the state, that have been given as, oh dear, I lost that term, when a person dies that they, not probate, could you help me with the term that I'm...
Well, bequeathed by will?
Well, it is, but there's a specific term that I'm searching for. But anyway, that's it, that they've willed over their stock. And a number of the stock has been willed to non-natives. And that was very surprising to me. And I think that we'll probably see more and more of that will to non-natives. And at the time that it can be given, given, rather than even willed. We're a very giving people. We've always shared. And I think that it's just in us to do that. So there's that fear, I know, of the 1991 and what is going to happen, but I think we have to educate our shareholders as to what the pros and cons are of either selling or giving stock away or lands or whatever the situation. I don't believe that there has been enough education to our shareholders about what the corporation's responsibilities are or what their responsibilities are to the corporation. It has to be a two-way flow, and I think that there hasn't been enough of that. I'm not sure how we can get the information out more. The written material doesn't seem to be working as well. I think it's got to be on a one-on-one basis. But it very much bothers me that what I want to say to our Native people. What I'm saying into this mic is for the benefit of our Native people. And it bothers me when I look out here and I see non-natives writing down things, and I don't know whether I'm going to be quoted in the newspaper or quoted on TV or quoted incorrectly, which I'm sure that you've read many of your articles that you say, wait a minute, I didn't say that, because I certainly have. And it bothers me that when I say that I followed this commission by what's been written in the paper. I don't know if it's correct. I really don't know that. I've certainly read some things that have been in the paper about some testimony here that I really question whether that was the true context of the testimony. If it was, it really bothers me greatly. But I don't know whether that written word is true. But I would like, when we're talking about our Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, and solutions and problems, to me, that we should have our Native people here to discuss it and not open it up to the public for people to say, mm-hmm, that's what I thought, or this is what they should be doing. And I feel like I'm bearing, like it's a confessional. And I don't feel that it should be that way. I feel that it should be to help our Native people, and that it should be accepted that way. I also wanted to point out that there have been reams and reams and reams of material written on ANSCA, and it seems like every time we start from scratch again on tell me again what you have to say, when I've said it before and before and before and before, that somehow we should pull from what has already been said too, not starting all over again. Also, I wanted to touch on the changes that it frightens me that our congressional delegation and with the 85 study, the report that's going to them, the 85 study frightened me very much, even more so than 1991. The 85 study, I have not seen it, but I don't know what's in it. I know parts of I know the outline, but in such a short time, with such a small amount of money, to come up with a full study to the congressional delegation who is going to use it for whatever, to make changes, to, I don't know what they're going to do with it. nobody knows what they're going to do with it. But that our congressional delegation right now, I don't think that there is probably more than 5% that are there now that were back there in 1960, late 60s or early 70s that had something to do with that act. And it frightens me that there are new people there who is going to look at it and say, wait a minute, you know, let's change this. Let's cut the benefits to the Native people. They had millions of dollars, they blew it, or they still have millions in their little treasure chest is growing, therefore we can cut the funds to them. They're on their own, we've given them enough, and all those kinds of things that we've heard in the past. It's very frightening. I don't believe that Congress in its wisdom in 1971 set up our act for prosperity, not to prosper. I think they set it up for failure. They set it up with all the little words, little loopholes that we might fail. And I don't think that when they read things of the negative, that they're shaking their heads in sorrow. I would venture that there's more of a smile on their face. I think we as Native people have to be careful about also our own state government. That when I'm told that there's 2,000 people a month moving to Anchorage from the lower 48, we know that the complexion of Alaska is changing and that we become more and more and more of a minority. I read, and I hope the rest of our Native people read the article in the paper about one of our Fairbanks legislators, in fact, who said he was very concerned about the amount of Native people moving into the pioneer homes because our percentage is only, I think, 11% or 12%, he stated, and that we shouldn't go beyond that percentage. Why, that's foolish. We aren't even beyond that, but that's the intelligence that some people have, that as we become more and more and more of a minority, then, for heaven's sakes, don't give Natives any more than 12%, any more than 10%, any more than 8%, because that's all the percentage we have in the state of Alaska. In a short time, one generation removed, two generations removed, excuse me, where Alaska was all Native people, with very, very few non-Native people here in the whole state of Alaska. And now, in my time, we're saying 12%, that's just